and welcome to episode 8 of That Yoga Woman's podcast, a podcast where yogis, yoga teachers, and studio owners share stories of their lives on and off the mat. I'm Jules Buchanan, a yoga teacher and your host. This week, I'm talking to Indira Dasgupta. Indira's been teaching yoga for 14 years, is a senior yoga teacher, and owns a yoga studio in North London, aptly named the North London Yoga Studio. She, like many of my guests so far, have had a previous career before teaching yoga. In Indira's case, it was journalism. So I'm really keen to explore that with her, as well as what led her into teaching yoga and how she found establishing her studio. Born in London to a Polish mom and an Indian dad, Indira attended a Catholic grammar school before going on to study at the University of Leeds. She then secured a spot on a prestigious postgraduate journalism diploma course before securing her first job at the London Evening Standard through what she calls positive discrimination in the 90s. I'm hoping she'll share more about her experience with us. She still writes articles and has recently written about her experiences around race in the context of the Black Lives Matter movement, so we'll talk about that too during the podcast. Indira is married with two children, so balances managing and growing her business with bringing up her family. And then there's COVID and the impact that that's had on her business. So we've got quite a lot of ground to cover. So thank you, Indira. Welcome to That Yoga Woman's podcast. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks for having me.
You're so welcome. It's really nice to speak to you. So going right back, you were born in London and you've got mixed race heritage. How did your parents meet and what was it like growing up?
So my mum's Polish and my dad was Indian. And so they actually met in Russia. So they were both tour guides, and my dad was with a group of Russian tourists in a restaurant. And then my mum's group came in and the two groups sort of sat together, and that's how they met.
Oh, that's such a cool story. Like, I knew they were like totally Poland and Indian, but I didn't expect you to say they met in Russia. That's like another crazy dimension to it.
It's a bit random. Yeah. Yeah. Aww. Obviously, they got married. So at that time, it was definitely very unusual to have that kind of mix. My mum comes from a small town in Poland, and I know that her parents weren't exactly over the moon.
Right.
And my dad didn't tell his mum. So his dad had already passed away, but he didn't tell his mum that he'd got married. And it was his plan, apparently, to tell her once I'd been born, because he knew that she would be accepting of her grandchild, but not particularly of the marriage. But she died before he told her.
Oh.
Yeah. So, yeah. So, but then subsequently, my parents had been to India, and he met, we all met my dad's brother and his older sister. So, yeah.
So was your dad living in the UK at the time?
Yeah. So my mum came to the UK to after they got married. Yeah.
Oh, so what was it like growing up?
Growing up, when I was younger, it definitely wasn't sort of considered to be cool to be Asian. Being Asian wasn't cool. It didn't feel like it was a cool thing to be, if that makes sense.
Hmm.
And, as it's just part and parcel of growing up, I'm sure anyone of my generation has memories of being called the P word, a Paki. You know, that was just, you know, standard, nothing particularly bad. I know that my younger brother had quite a lot of hassle growing up. When we used to go to Poland, because my mum comes from this really small town, we would literally be like the only brown people in the village, the only brown people in town, the only brown people, you know, for a 100-mile radius or something. You'd never ever see anyone that wasn't Polish. That's how it was, you know?
Yeah.
So, I've kind of written about this, but I'd go into a shop as like a 14-year-old or whatever, and everyone would be staring at me, and it was just, I'd be absolutely mortified. And then when we left the shop, I'd be saying to my mum, why is everybody staring at me? You know, and they're just curious. Yeah. But when you're self-conscious, you know, it's just, yeah.
Yeah, as a teenager, you don't need that.
Yeah, yeah, it's really excruciating. But yeah, that, you know, it's just, yeah. I never met anyone with my sort of mix growing up. And in fact, I think in my entire life, I've only met, I know one lady who has kids at my daughter's school. So she's Polish and her husband is British Asian. So he was born here. It's the only time I've come across that mix. Yeah.
So even more unique.
Yes. Yeah. I quite like it though. I like being unique. Yeah. I think I'd be kind of annoyed if I met lots of people with the same mix. I've got used to it now.
You feel special.
Yes. Yeah, definitely.
So you went to a Catholic grammar school.
Yeah.
So that was really selective, like not just the Catholic bit, but the grammar bit too. And I wrongly presumed you weren't a Catholic, but you were brought up a Catholic, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, I wouldn't say that being a Catholic was a big part of my life until I went to the Catholic secondary school. Hmm. And the reason my parents sent me there was because it was considered to be a good school, not because it was Catholic, basically. So
yeah,
my mother didn't go to a Catholic school. I think I was barely aware of being a Catholic until I went to this school. And then, yeah, basically they just used to ram it down their throats constantly, the Catholicism. So ironically, it just put me off the religion for quite a long time. Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to ask how your experience was and how it shaped your views.
So I just found that, you know, it was a girls' school, and, you know, we had RE lessons where they'd really bang on about abortion being a sin. And, you know, I was always quite sort of, opinionated. So I would sort of put my hand up and say, oh, well, what about, you know, what if a girl or a woman is a victim of rape? You know, would you still say it's wrong to have an abortion? And the answer was no. You know, sorry, the answer was yes, it's still wrong. Yeah. And that was just, I just remember at the time just thinking I just can't agree with that, you know. So that put me off Catholicism. And then, both my kids go to a Catholic school. They went to a Catholic primary school.
So did they?
Because it's a good school, basically. Yeah. Again, I wasn't really led by the religious aspect. And so I was teaching yoga at the school, but then it got banned because one of the mums at the school, actually a Polish mum, she'd been told by her priest that the Catholic religion doesn't approve of yoga. And so the priest at the time, the sort of school priest, kind of looked into it and then said to the headmistress, I don't think we should be doing yoga at the school anymore.
Wow. So that,
yeah. And then I went to meet him to kind of have a chat about it. And there was just no way I was ever going to change his mind. It just, yeah, it put me off Catholicism again. yeah, unfortunately, yeah.
And it's like a little double insult to injury when it's this, a Polish mum. It's just like putting a boot in, isn't
really.
It?
Really, I mean, I think that's what she'd been told by her priest, you know. I think there are elements, there are some people in the Catholic Church that probably take a more hardline view of it. Mm. You know, not all, obviously, as with any religion, not everyone is as strict or whatever, do you know what I mean?
But
I think there were lots of parents that were very happy for me to be teaching yoga and were disappointed that it got pulled, but you know.
Yeah, it is what it is, I guess. Yeah. Did you find another venue then?
Well, so I was just, I mean, you know, I was, I think I already had my yoga studio then.
So it's just extra.
Yeah, yeah, it was because I wanted to do it, you know, I believed in it, so.
So a lot of people move in and out of London from across the UK and from abroad. Like in episode 3, I talked to Zoe Rowe, who moved to London just from Milton Keynes. But growing up there, like, what was it like to be born in the capital city?
Well, I mean, I guess that's all I'd ever known. So for me, it was completely, you know, the norm. I've always loved the fact about London that it's an ethnic melting pot, that it's so diverse culturally, you know, that there's just such a great mix of people, influences. I think that's probably London's greatest asset. And so I remember that. So as part of my degree, I went to Moscow for 9 months.
Wow.
And back when I was in Moscow, so this is, we're talking like about 24 years ago. When I was in Moscow, there really wasn't a mix then. So, you know, that was really weird for me to go from being in a city where, you know, there's just this diverse mix of peoples, and then going to a city where you stick out like a sore thumb. So yeah, that was something that I always really liked about London.
And then you went up to study in Leeds.
Yes, yeah.
So what was it about Leeds that made you want to study there? How did you find it?
I think I just, when I went to visit it, I just thought it was a cool city, and it was and is, yeah. So I had a great time at Leeds. So I did my degree in politics, Russian and parliamentary studies. And as I mentioned, part of my degree, I spent my third year in Moscow. So that was quite an experience.
So yeah. What did you select Russian? Was that from the Polish influence a little bit, or where did Russian come into it?
Well, so I originally applied to do politics. And then once I got my letter of acceptance, they sent a letter in that mentioning this new degree. So it was a very new degree. And, you know, they mentioned that you got to spend 9 months in Moscow. And I just thought, oh, that sounds pretty cool.
So had you spoken any Russian before?
No, I'd never done any Russian before. So it was really hard. It's a really hard language, yeah. And I think, so my mum had always been interested in Russian culture and the Russian language. But actually, I sort of subsequently discovered that that's quite unusual, because when my mum was growing up, they were forced to learn Russian. So a lot of people resented it and actually didn't remember any of it, you know. So, it was a tough language. It's a tough language.
Did any of it stick, Indira? Can you still speak a little bit?
I think so. You know, sometimes when I'm watching television and, you know, if there's not a Russian character, they're normally an evil spy or something, aren't they, if it's an American film. I do understand it. I think I would struggle to speak it in a really convincing way, but yeah, because I haven't used it since I left. So
right. It's
probably there. I just haven't used it.
So that was politics you studied, politics and Russian and business. Yes. Was it business as well? Yeah.
Politics, Russian and parliamentary studies. Yeah.
So was it at that, like, what led you into journalism after that?
So I already knew I wanted to be a journalist. I'd known that for quite a long time. I think it was just something that somebody I know had told me that she wanted to be a journalist when I was growing up, and I didn't even know what a journalist was. And when she explained it, I thought, oh, that sounds cool. You get to travel and meet people. And then, you know, it just sort of went on from there, really. So at Leeds, they certainly did when I was there, they had a really good award-winning student newspaper. So I was lucky enough to get involved with that, and that kind of helped me, you know, in terms of building my skills and experience. And I always, you know, when we were at school, I always opted to do work experience at a local newspaper. So again, you know, just trying to build up my experience and, you know, learn what it was really like to be a news reporter.
So after uni, that's why you knew straight away you went and tried to get onto this postgraduate journalism diploma course, because that's by then you knew you wanted to
absolutely.
Was that quite hard to get onto, was it?
I think so, yeah. I think it's considered to be a pretty sort of you know, that there's a lot of they've got quite a lot of famous alumni, you know, people that attended the course and have gone on to do great things in journalism. So, yeah, it was a really good course. I was really lucky to get onto it. And, yeah, it was, you know, it was tough, but it was a good experience. And we used to have this exercise called off diary. So this gives you an idea of how old I am. So we used to get a page out of the teacher would print a page off the A to Z, just a random page, any page. And she'd say, right, you can go to anywhere on this page. And then you've got to find two stories and come back and write up your stories by, you know, whatever, 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Wow. So that,
yeah. Yeah. It's quite terrifying. Yeah.
Yeah. It's quite challenging. Yeah, I'm sure there's a show on the radio a bit like that at the minute, on Radio 4. I don't know what it's called, but yeah, it sounds like they give them a postcode and then they have to go to the postcode and like dig around and see what they can find there. But it's a bit random.
Exactly like that. Yeah, it's exactly like that. Yeah.
Oh, so had you discovered yoga at this point?
No. So I didn't discover yoga until after I left the Evening Standard, and I went traveling with my friend. And the first country we visited was India. So I did yoga in India, in Goa.
Wow. How was that first class?
So yeah, I enjoyed it when I did it, but I wouldn't say I sort of immediately fell in love with it and thought, right, this is it. This is what I want to do. It sort of developed quite slowly initially. And it wasn't for... quite a while after that I decided to kind of make it my job. Yeah.
Did you dip in and out, or did you think, well, this is a class I'd like to continue on when you finish traveling? Did you make yoga a part of your life?
I started practicing yoga when I came back. Mm-hmm. And then after not too long, I decided to do my teacher training, but I didn't sort of think, oh, I'm going to do my teacher training and then I'm going to become a yoga teacher, if that makes sense. I wasn't planning on giving up journalism. So then I was just teaching like one class a week. Then I had my kids. then after I had my kids, I was working for a charity, doing PR. And then after that, I just decided to make a go of it, just really commit myself to yoga.
Just going back into the journalism, you mentioned in a recent article that you think securing your first reporting role at the London Evening Standard was through positive discrimination. Can you just tell us a little bit about what happened?
Okay, yeah. So while I was doing my postgraduate diploma in journalism, like everyone else, I was sending off letters and... to various newspapers, and I wrote a letter to the London Evening Standard actually applying for their graduate trainee scheme, which didn't even exist. So I hadn't really done my research. So they should have binned it on the grounds that I hadn't done my research, but luckily for me, they didn't. And I can only imagine that I think at that time, you know, it was just sort of a time where I think the media was recognising that it was very kind of, it was dominated by white people, and that it was time to make it more ethnically diverse. And they obviously saw that I had this name, Indira Dasgupta. So, you know, realised that I probably wasn't white. And so I got invited in for an interview. And when I went for the interview, and even after they offered me the position. So they basically set up this graduate trainee scheme. I was the first person on this trainee scheme. I didn't realise that the sort of point of this scheme was they specifically wanted to target people from ethnic minority backgrounds. It was never really presented to me as that. And it was only really after I'd been working there for a while, and I went for lunch with the news editor, and he just made this throwaway comment where he said, oh, it's ironic really, isn't it, that you're the first person we've had on this scheme and you're not even that Indian. Yeah. So that's when the penny drops. And also in my interview as well, my very first interview, the very first question they asked me was, where are you from? And in the interview, I just assumed they meant, which area of London are you from? So I said, oh, I'm from Southgate. It's in North London. And again, I only found out afterwards that they thought I was being really clever and witty because I hadn't given them the full synopsis of where my parents were from.
Yeah.
It was just a classic, where are you really from? But I hadn't even noticed, you know.
No, no. Yeah. But they thought, oh, wow, she's so sharp. She's not giving us what we want.
I just thought, because that's the thing. I just thought, well, I'm from Southgate. I'm, you know, that's where I'm from. I grew up in London. I'm British. So yeah. Why would I give you the full synopsis of where my mum comes from, where my dad comes from, you know?
No, it wouldn't be expected from anyone else, would it, really? No. If you just ask where you're from, that's it.
Yeah.
And I'm so interested in this, Indira. Like, what was it like to work in a newsroom? Like, bear in mind, I've not had much exposure. Well, no, zero exposure to actual newsrooms. The exposure I've had is an image of Clark Kent, Lois Lane, Jimmy coming in. It's just an image from the 80s, people busy on the typewriters, deadlines. Like, what's it like? I know you've been out of it for a while, but what's it like to work in a sort of more modern newsroom?
And well, it's definitely changed a lot since I was a journalist, and my husband's still a journalist, so I know that. Still works in the same building that I used to work in. So I'm not that old that we were using typewriters. We did
have... Sorry if I implied that.
It's all right, don't worry, it's fine. But I am old enough to remember that you were allowed to smoke in the newsroom back then.
Ah, it's so mad, isn't it, that?
This guy who I sat opposite on my first day, and he had four packs of Marlboro Lights next to his computer, and one fag on the go, just constantly smoking. Yeah. So yes, it was quite, I mean, you know, a lot of the cliches that you see on television about journalists, I suppose maybe there's some truth to it. You know, there was a lot of drinking, a lot of socializing, a lot of strong characters, you know, very tight deadlines. So especially with the London Evening Standard, they used to have like four different editions a day. So you would be on different shifts. So one week you might be starting at 5 a.m. and finishing at midday. Another week you might be starting at midnight and finishing at 7 a.m. And if you were just doing like a standard shift where you started at 10 a.m, you know, because there were so many editions, sometimes you would be given a story to do, you know, in less than half an hour, you know, or someone would come up to you and say, oh, there's this thing happening. You've got, you know, can you go? And it would already started and you'd get there, you know, like a press conference. You wouldn't know what the hell it was about, or, you know, and then you'd have to like quickly try and absorb as much information as you could, you know, and then... Back then, we used to have copy takers, so you'd kind of scribble down your story in your notepad, and then you'd have to read it out to these copy takers who would print it all, who type it all up for you. Yeah, so that's how it used to work. Yeah,
that sounds quite a good gig. I didn't know that role existed. I assumed if it was on your notepad, you would be typing it.
Well, that's, you know, when I was a journalist, we had. Mobile phones, but they were old, you know, they were like bricks. There was no internet connection or anything like that. You couldn't send emails from them. So in a way, so back then and even before that, you had to go to the story. If you wanted to write a story about something, you had to go to the story. Whereas I know that, you know, as things changed, people would be writing about things that they actually hadn't, you know, they hadn't been there. They're just literally rewriting copy, you know? So yeah. Stories that are already out there, just rewriting it a bit and then presenting it as their own story. Whereas back in the day, you had to go to the story. There was no other option. Hmm. So you were here, there and everywhere, you know?
Yeah. So you said that you'd felt you'd got pigeonholed pretty quickly in terms of the stories that you were sent to report on. Can you give some examples and tell me a bit more about that?
Yeah, sure. So 9/11 happened while I was at the Evening Standard. And that kind of really changed a lot of things because, you know, this whole thing about Islamophobia then became, you know, a sort of ongoing issue. And so I can remember once the deputy news editor coming up to me and saying, oh, you know, we want to, I don't know, maybe there was some new proposals or something from the government, and we want to find out what the Muslim community think about it. So we want you to go out and get some views from the Muslim community. I'm not going to tell you where to go because I'm sure you know where to go. You know, it's like, A, I'm not Muslim. You know, do you know what I mean? Just the presumption that because I'm brown, I've sort of got some kind of hotline to a Muslim spokesperson. But then, of course, you want to prove yourself as a journalist. So you don't say that. You just use your common sense and think, okay, well, I would imagine I'll find some Muslim people perhaps at a mosque. So, you know, yeah. So, yeah, it's just that sort of thing. I was basically like their kind of unofficial brown correspondent, really, I suppose. Yeah. And so, you know, another sort of example I would give was that they, so I was asked to go undercover as a hospital cleaner, which really wasn't much fun. I did it. And then I think like maybe a year after I'd done it, they asked me to do it again. And I just thought, oh God, you're joking. You know, whereas obviously maybe some of the, shall we say, I don't know, maybe other people in the newsroom who were, for want of a better adjective, posher than me, they wouldn't have been asked to go undercover as a hospital cleaner. And I guess you could say, well, yes, because you're not going to believe that someone with a public school accent could be a hospital cleaner. But, you know, anyway, yeah.
Oh, so how did all of that make you feel, Indira?
Well, you know, I mean,
I guess at the time, you just have to get on with it.
I think so. Of course, there were times where I was angry or annoyed about it. I can remember once I was writing a story about the Asian Rich List, which, you know, the Sunday Times compiles. I'd been asked to write a story, and then some guy on the news desk, after I'd written it, he came up to me and said, look, you've got to rewrite this. You know, you haven't got the essence of it. Basically, you really need to get across the message that these are people that, you know, started off as bus drivers. It was just all complete, like, stereotyping, you know. And sometimes you don't even really know how to respond. You just know it's not right, but you can't really articulate it. And yeah, and I'm so there was also another female reporter who she was born here like myself, but has Asian parents, and they used to mix us up all the time. I know, it's so cringe. We literally, yeah. Still friends with her now. We literally do not look alike at all. And actually sometimes they would do it deliberately as a joke, as if it was really funny. Yeah.
Yeah. That's way worse. Like, it's all wrong, isn't it? But that's worse. It's not funny at all. That must have been awful. You'd hate to be mistaken for someone else who didn't even look similar just because you've got a similar skin tone or background, or in their mind you're just interchangeable. So just a bit along that vein, you've recently written that you'd rather be judged by your teaching than achieve more visibility by being like highlighted on a list of yoga teachers of color. And you also wrote in a recent article that the term woman of color makes you cringe a little bit. Can you expand on your sentiments there?
I guess I just find it, I mean, it's always really hard. I think lots of people would agree with this. It's really hard to know what term to use, but I just feel like women of color is so sort of vague. It's like, what does that mean? Any woman who's not white? I mean, it doesn't allow for the fact that that's just a massive group, isn't it? And two different women of color may have completely different experiences. So to sort of just lump us together is just not really very satisfactory, you know. But it's tricky because they keep changing the terms, don't they, as well. I mean, I can barely keep up with it myself. So yes, I mean, I have used that term, but I always, it always jars with me a little bit because, yeah, for want of a better description. And so, yeah, coming back to that idea of why do I not want to be judged on my colour? I mean, because, you know, my colour is just one aspect of who I am. It has no impact whatsoever on my teaching, you know. Yeah, I'd rather that people, yeah, of course I'd like to be recognised as a good yoga teacher, but I don't want to be, you know, I don't want to be included as an act of tokenism. I don't want to be the token non-white person, you know. Oh no, we haven't got a non-white teacher, quick, let's get her in there. You know, she's got a foreign sounding name, so yeah, that's going to tick a couple of boxes, you know. That's not, yeah. I just want to be recognized on my own merits, like everybody wants to, right? You know.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. I'm just going to read you back something as well that you've written, if you don't mind.
Sure.
You also wrote recently that for many years I told myself that the reason things didn't work out for me as a journalist was because I wasn't very good at office politics, that it was too abrasive. Yes, in a nutshell, I was just too feisty for my own good. Basically, I blamed myself. I even tried to actively tone down the more fiery aspects of my personality. So reflecting on that now, do you believe that the combination of your race and sex was an impediment to your progress as a journalist?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, I do. In fact, so that article was really inspired by a conversation that I had with two of my friends from my Evening Standard days. So one of them is the woman I mentioned who we used to get mixed up. Mm-hmm. And the other woman, she was the second person to get a place on this graduate trainee scheme. So she's mixed race like me, but her mother's from Ghana. And I think her dad is Scottish. Anyway, so we were having a chat and I made some comment to the effect that, you know, I was no good at the office politics and, you know, I was always rubbing people up the wrong way or something or other. And yeah, my friend, you know, she said that it made her really sad to think that I was blaming myself, you know, because I don't know, I guess sometimes you sort of think, well, why do these things keep happening to me? It must be something that I'm doing, surely, because otherwise it's like you're not accepting responsibility. I don't know. Yeah, I just think maybe the combination was possibly too much, that if I could be feisty and brown and a man, or I could be, you know, I just couldn't be a woman, feisty and brown. That was just too much for people to deal with. I think, yeah, I probably just made people feel uncomfortable because they didn't know how to sort of react towards me or deal with me. I don't know. But yeah.
This is probably a bit of an unfair question. Do you think it's changed? Like, how long have you been left journalism now? Like, how long has it been?
Oh, it's been a long time. It's been a long time. I mean, I don't know about, I mean, so quite recently, there was a kind of mini campaign. I saw, you know, so some journalists that I know had signed this letter calling on the media to readdress the sort of the ethnic, the fact that it's still predominantly white journalism. So yeah, the fact that campaign, you know, we're talking just maybe a month ago, right, that is still an issue, speaks for itself. And I think one issue is that there maybe are a few prominent British Asian journalists, but there are even fewer prominent Black journalists. So yeah, that just tells you, I think, you know, the problem with journalism, I think, is that, so I did a lot of unpaid work experience before I even got my job at the Evening Standard. And a lot of people just aren't in a position to do that. You know, I wouldn't say my parents were not exactly supportive of my decision to go into journalism, but I did have the luxury of being able to work for free. And that is a luxury. You know, I know somebody who, you know, without naming names, he's a really successful journalist now. He basically did unpaid work experience at The Observer for a year before he got a paid job. I mean, who can afford to do that?
Yeah. Well, yeah.
You just can't, can you?
No.
So, you know, you've got to get out there and especially now, you know, start paying off your student loan. And, you know, when I was at university, I didn't have to pay tuition fees, thank God, because otherwise maybe things might have been different, you know? So I think that's a big problem, yeah. And also, you know, with journalism, because there's no... So it's not like other jobs where, like, you see roles advertised and then there's this formal kind of process of application and interviewing. It is literally, you know, you just hear about things or you just apply for things or you start off with a few shifts and then you build your way up. So there isn't really a kind of structured route in. Yeah, it's a tough profession. Yeah, for sure.
Sounds it. So you from the Standard, you went on to work at some celebrity magazines like Closer, Heat. I used to love Heat. And you even worked at Lads Mag Zoo. I mean, I was shocked when I found that out. I don't know why. So I used to be an avid Heat reader. You're shocked. I used to love Heat. Like in my early 20s, I bought it all the time. But then I sort of stopped knowing who's in it. And now I don't know anyone who's in it. But what were those working environments like? I can imagine what it would be like. But you tell us, what was it like?
So I didn't work at either of those magazines for long. So they're all of those magazines that you've just mentioned are EMAP magazines.
Ah, okay.
There used to be this little saying that EMAP stood for endless meetings and parties. So you can make of that what you will. It's very, very, very different to working at the Evening Standard, you know, very, like, pretty chilled. I mean, you know, going, you know, for me, to move from working from a publication where you'll produce, there's four issues a day, to working for a weekly, the pace is just unbelievably different. And I think that's something that I've carried through with me, that if you're used to doing things that quickly, then I'm just sort of gobsmacked at how slow everybody was on the weekly. It's like, you know, because you're just used to, like, come on, do it, you know. So it was fun. It was, but yeah, Heat was fun. I was there for quite a short period of time. Closer, just completely different. You're writing about a completely different subject matter, you know.
Did you interview any celebs, Indira?
No, not in person. I remember I had to go and follow up a story about Charlotte Church. So I had to go to Wales and, you know, go and try and speak to her mum and her boyfriend and things like that. You know, I think that was one of the aspects of journalism that I always felt uncomfortable with. It's called door knocking, where you literally turn up on someone's door, at someone's doorstep, uninvited, and knock on their door. And knocking on Charlotte Church's mum's door is one thing, but then we used to, like at the Evening Standard, it's called a death knock, where if somebody's died, you'd go and knock on the door of their surviving relatives, hoping that they're going to tell you their story. And that is the worst. That's the worst, yeah.
So, yeah, it's just intrusive to the max, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. It really is, yeah. Yeah, so I definitely don't miss that. And so there's the Lads Mag. I mean, how that came about. So I was working at EMAP and I saw on their sort of like internal website that they were advertising for a news editor, and they described it as a new, because it hadn't been launched, the magazine.
Okay.
They described it as a new newsy weekly for men, right? That's how it was described, newsy weekly for men. Wow. And they were looking for a news editor. So I thought, okay, that sounds really interesting. You know, yeah. Background in news. I'm going to apply. And then when I went for the interview, I saw the dummy issue of the magazine. I'm like, oh, okay.
I'd love to see your face.
It's not very newsy. Not very newsy at all, actually.
Newsy with a little tiny small N.
At that point, I think I've been out of work for a little while, and I just thought, oh God, right, I'm just going to give it a go and see how it goes. It's certainly an experience. So as I say, I kind of fell into it sort of by accident. I didn't like seek it out. Yeah, it was a bit of an eye opener, and not necessarily in a good way. I think it's probably best that I parted ways after not too long. So what else can I say? Yeah, you know, there's definitely some memory. I mean, I could probably write a book about some of the stuff that happened, but so some of the more repeatable anecdotes, shall I say. I remember once there was this couple that had been barred from every pub in Britain. And so every pub in Britain. So we decided that we would send the pub to them. So we sent this like mobile bar to their house. That was one story. I remember there was also this guy who'd spelt out, he was a shepherd, he'd spelt out, I love you, or no, will you marry me, or something, to his girlfriend in sheep. So I contacted him and got him to spell out zoo in sheep. And he did it. That was quite cool. That's the more repeatable stuff. Yeah.
How can that qualify as work? It doesn't feel like it would be work. It's just funny. Just like crazy ridiculousness.
I have to do loads of stories. Like, so normally the headlines would always be like the biggest or worst or highest or most scary. It's always superlatives, you know, like the fastest car in the world or the most dangerous gang in the world. You know, it's always like that was kind of the style. Yeah. Yeah, there's quite a lot of stuff about gangs and yeah, that was kind of, it wasn't news. No, it definitely wasn't news. Yeah.
But to be fair, it's like you said, it wasn't even a magazine when you joined. So you weren't to know what that would be, what you were getting into.
No, with me, I'm just the sort of person that I never give up on something because it seems really difficult, you know?
Yeah.
So of course I was thinking, oh my God, how on earth am I going to be the news editor for this magazine? Like how? But it just wouldn't be in my nature to go, right, I can't do it. So I'm not going to do it. I would just be right. Just going to get on with it and do it.
Yeah. And in a way, because it hadn't been done before, there was no one, you weren't stepping into someone's shoes. You could just crack on and.
I mean, it deteriorated in the short amount of time I was there. It became progressively less newsy and more sort of sensationalist.
Was that your fault? What are you trying to say?
No, I mean, then I left. They replaced me. You know, I was never going to be. I mean, it's still a mystery to me. I think the only reason I ended up being the news editor is because they didn't have anyone else.
That's so harsh on yourself.
No, it's true. Because why would they want, you know, a female, a sort of mixed race woman who used to work for the Evening Standard as their news editor? It doesn't make any sense. You know, I didn't know anything about football. Nothing. I knew nothing about football. That was like 80% of the magazine was football. I didn't have a clue. I had no idea.
Just to give it an air of respectability, maybe. So after that experience, you went on to work as a senior reporter at Third Sector, a magazine for the not-for-profit sector. So what was that like? I guess it was like a calmer and kinder environment, maybe revolving around the charity sector. That's how I would feel it would be. But was it like that?
Well, it was very, very different from Zoo. There's no doubt about that. Very, very different from the Standard and Heat and Closer. I mean, I would say, you know, in terms of the kind of office environment, it was very, very tame in comparison with other places I'd worked at. One thing I did really enjoy about Third Sector, and so because it was a trade magazine, I was really able to focus on my writing and, you know, do more sort of investigative pieces and lots of kind of in-depth interviews and, you know, really do the kind of journalism that I'd always wanted to do, but hadn't had the opportunity to, you know. So from that point of view, it was great. I enjoyed the actual, you know, the work, but... it's a trade magazine, so it wasn't like a widely read magazine, you know, just read by people in the not-for-profit industry. So yeah.
And then after that, you worked for a charity for people with spinal cord injuries as their PR and comms manager. How was that?
I just kind of after I'd had my son, I just happened to see this job advertised, and I'd been wanting, so one of the reasons I started working for Third Sector is because I did have an interest in the not-for-profit industry, and I really wanted, that was something I wanted to move into, working for a charity. And so when I saw this role, it seemed kind of ideal. So I was basically in charge of their entire PR and comms, but it was only a part-time job. And really that job was, I mean, they should have had two people working full-time minimum, you know? So it was kind of an impossible task, you know? And I think that was proven by the fact that when I left, they made it a full-time role. So I was fitting 5 days work into 3 days and being paid 3 days, which I think is probably something a lot of women who work part-time can familiarise with.
Yeah, I've heard that as well from
friends. Yeah, you just fit 5 days work into 3 days, that's it, yeah.
I've even heard it from a friend who used to bill her hours out, and she knew how many hours she was billing out. It was still only paid 3 days.
Yeah.
So when and why did you decide to become a yoga teacher? You said when you did your training, you weren't expecting to be a yoga teacher. Like that wasn't what you saw for yourself. So how did it kind of transpire that you ended up, you did one class a week, you said, just alongside your other work?
I had a bit of a break. So after I had my daughter, and then I, you know, around the time that I was thinking of getting back into teaching, things just weren't going that well in my job with the charity. It was a really long commute as well. It was like taking me at least an hour and 15 minutes each way. Mm. And, you know, with two young kids, it just wasn't really, wasn't really workable. My son was about to go to school, and it just logistically, it just really wasn't going to work. Mm. And it just kind of felt like, well, things weren't going that well either. And then I was offered I was offered a sort of teaching slot at a leisure centre. And it just felt like, you know, one door closes, another door opens. It almost felt like fate.
Yeah.
And I think I just thought, you know what, I'm going to make a go of the yoga. And I knew that I know a big part of why I decided to focus on the yoga, there's a few things. I wanted to have a job that would allow me to have a good work-life balance so that I could fit my job in around my children, not my children in around my job. That was the choice I made. Mm. And yeah, I'd really tried with journalism and, you know, come up against brick walls, and you know, I'd tried working for the charity. And I just, you know, I'm just not the sort of person that all the meetings and all the bureaucracy just drove me a bit crazy. You know, we'd have all these meetings and I just think, can't we just get on already and do it? Why do we have to talk about it endlessly? So it just wasn't really for me. I don't think, yeah, I think I'm definitely better off working for myself. Definitely, yeah, yeah.
And your children, do they do yoga?
So I have taught kids yoga on and off over the years. So I when I was teaching kids yoga at the studio for a while, they were coming with me. Mm. They were doing that. And even sort of during lockdown, I was teaching kids yoga on Zoom and my daughter was doing that. So they don't do yoga with me as such, but, you know, like sometimes my son will say, oh, I've got really tight hamstrings, so I'll give him stretches to do. Or, you know, my daughter is hypermobile. So, you know, we've done a few exercises to try and help her with her stability. And, you know, sometimes she'll just do tree pose and say, oh, look, mummy, I'm doing tree pose. And we also do occasionally do something called the Lotus of Gratitude, which is like a mindfulness exercise. So, you know, if they're moaning about stuff, I sometimes get them to do the Lotus of Gratitude just to try and get them to focus on all the, you know, many things that they have going for them, you know. Yeah, so I feel like they're kind of absorbing the benefits of yoga through my example rather than by directly doing it themselves, if that makes sense. I would never dream of kind of forcing them to do it because I don't want it to be something that they resent doing. And even when I was doing the Zoom classes with my daughter, say she would do it with me while we were, I was teaching maybe some of her friends. Quite often she'd be pretty reluctant to do it, if the truth be known. But I felt that she really needed to do it to help improve her stability. But yeah, I don't want to force it on them, you know. I want them to enjoy it and maybe they'll rediscover it. Or, you know, if my daughter's feeling, you know, she's got a bit of a temper, I'll try and get her to focus on her breathing and things like that. But I don't say, like, come on, let's do half an hour of yoga and we bust out some sun salutations. That's not what happens at home now.
No. So from being a yoga teacher then to owning your own studio, it's a big, well, I see that as quite a big move. You founded your studio in 2013. Mm-hmm. What challenges did you face? And could you just share some of your successes as well in setting it up? Like, how did it come about?
Oh, so you probably realised by now that when I do things, I just sort of throw myself headlong into them and don't kind of sit there and weigh up all the pros and cons and, oh, is this a good idea? Or I just, seems like a good idea and then I just go for it. And, you know, maybe if I thought about things more, I possibly wouldn't do them. But I think with the studio, I sort of realised pretty early on that I did not want to be travelling here, there and everywhere to do classes at leisure centres. You know, there's a lot of time spent, yeah, just travelling from one place to the other. And I just figured that it made more sense to have one base, and to really focus on that. And I knew a lady who, you know, we're still friends now, who was a really sort of well-established local yoga teacher. So I approached her and said, you know, haven't you ever thought about having a studio? And sort of convinced her that we should set up a studio together. I think if I'd done it on my own, that probably would have been too daunting, maybe. So my daughter was only like two at the time. So I'm really glad I had someone to do it with. And when we initially set it up, the way we set it up was that other teachers were renting the space. So we weren't employing them. So it was more like, you know, premises where I taught from there, she taught from there, other teachers taught from there, but there wasn't like a kind of cohesive, there wasn't like a team of us, if that makes sense. We're all kind of doing our own thing. And then in 2018, I went to India for 7 months with my family. And so Jackie, my business partner, was managing the studio on her own. And I think she realized that she didn't really enjoy all the admin that goes along with running a studio. So when I came back, actually before I came back, she said she would rather do her own thing. So I took her over on my own, and I've been doing it on my own since we got back. And when I took over, I decided to introduce a membership scheme, you know, and so then I started employing the teachers. So basically I started running the studio in the way that I'd always wanted to, really. So yeah, so it's been hard work. It really has, really hard work. And obviously, particularly in the last sort of 6 months with the pandemic.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, in the last 6 months, how's it been? It's
been a testing time for everybody. Yes, anyway, go on. Yeah, ask away.
That's what I was going to say. Like, how has it affected your business? Like, it obviously challenging time through lockdown, and now with social distancing, still having rent and rates to pay, like, how have you been managing?
Well, so I'm very grateful that I got a grant. So that's helped enormously. My landlord didn't give me a rent break or a rent reduction or anything like that. So basically my grant has primarily gone towards paying my rent, but at least I haven't had to pay it out of my own pocket. So, you know, that's definitely something to be grateful for. So I've been, you know, like a lot of teachers, I just moved classes online. And then since September, we've been reopened. Because it's a very small space, my maximum capacity now is just 5. And that's not a lot of people. Not all the classes have been full either. You know, I've had to cancel classes. So, yeah, I mean, I did think very seriously about how long I could continue like that. And I actually even reached the decision that I couldn't really continue. And I had decided to close. But then, sort of funnily enough, when I gave my landlord, handed in my notice, then he finally decided to offer me a rent reduction.
Wow.
So I'm still paying full rent. But he said that for the next 3 months after October, he'll give me 50% off my rent. So that makes a big difference. So I guess, like a lot of people, I'm just taking it each day as it comes. Just seeing how it goes.
Yeah.
What else can you do? Yeah, you know, who knows what the future holds? I certainly don't. I don't think any of us do we?
No.
There's also a lot of competition locally. So since the studio opened, you know, 2 more studios have opened within a 2-mile radius. And then you have to add to that the leisure centres. I mean, the amount of competition is just crazy. And I think it's sort of reached saturation levels in London. And I really wouldn't like to be a newly qualified yoga teacher in London at this time, or possibly even anywhere. I just think the competition is crazy. And I really think there are too many teacher training schemes or whatever. I think we need to be realistic, you know. With that many teachers, it's going to be really hard for all those teachers to make a decent living out of teaching yoga. It's a fact.
Yeah, you're right, because there's a lot, isn't there, even since I started which isn't that long ago. And it's, you know, I'm new myself. And it is a lot of competition and hard, but especially when it's like every village hall or on every corner, there's a studio. I guess it's a bit like that in the States, I would imagine. I suppose we're getting it, seeing a bit of an impact like that here, where it is, there's a lot of yoga around. Is it too much?
I just think the fact is that it's really hard, not impossible, but it's really hard to make a decent living out of being a full-time yoga teacher, you know? And you see, like, obviously the yoga celebrities, but they're the exception, not the rule. I get contacted by newly qualified yoga teachers every week who want to go on my cover list, you know?
Really, that often?
Probably, not far off, yeah. And I have to say no. And another thing I think, you know, is a little bugbear of mine. I think if you're going to become a yoga teacher, don't become a yoga teacher if you're not prepared to self-promote. Just forget about it, you know. And it's quite frustrating for me that I have teachers that even now are reluctant to self-promote. That you just don't have the luxury, you know. You don't have the luxury of being shy if you want to be a yoga teacher. You just don't. And just, you know, doing a post that says, I'm going to be teaching a class at 7:30 on Wednesday, you know, the day before your class, it's not good enough, you know. I think there needs to be, yeah, definitely, you know, yoga teacher training now really needs to include much more on, you know, the business side of it, self-promotion, marketing, all of that. I mean, I'm sure you know, as a yoga teacher, actually quite a small percentage of what you do is teaching yoga. You know, you've got to do your own website, your social media posts, deal with inquiries, you know.
Yeah, definitely. I'm not leaving you hanging. I totally agree.
Yeah, you know, and it's hard. I mean, I remember when I first started, I was sort of relatively late to Facebook and Instagram, and I found it hard. I really did. I struggled with it. Yeah. But then I just sort of had to get over myself. So, just get on with it and deal with it. This is the reality, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I was really late to Facebook too. I resisted for years. I knew it would be sucking my time and energy. So when it started coming out, I resisted it. Friends were like, come on, get on it. No. And I had this thing, like, if you weren't my friend in real life, then, you know, they were probably not meant to be friends anymore. So I thought, it's not like, you just need, like, I remember going to one of Dawn's events, Dawn Wright from episode 2. And she said there was a bunch, you might have been there, Indira, I don't know. There's a bunch of teachers, and she just said, oh, who's got a Facebook page? Everyone put their hands up. I just sat there like, oh. So she said, all right, let's just say who hasn't got a Facebook page for the business. I put my hand up. I was the only one. It was mortifying, but she's like, Jules, come on. And she said that it's a no-brainer. It's like, okay. But yeah, it's hard, isn't it, when you don't really know what you're doing?
No, because you make it, I mean, I've learned so much just on, you know, as I go along. You're just learning as you go along, you know, and like, especially with all the Zoom stuff and live streaming from the classes from the studio, I don't know what I'm doing half the time. I'm just winging it. I'm just like, oh, I hope this microphone's the right microphone when I order it from Amazon. I guess there's only one way to find out, you know, order it, try it. You know, I mean, I love being a yoga teacher. I really, really do. There's so much that, you know, there's so much that's great about being a yoga teacher, but it's not easy. It's definitely not easy. And of course, you know, even if you're teaching, let's just say, so at the moment I'm teaching about 12 classes a week, you know, that's just the classes you're teaching. People don't maybe realize how much is going on, you know, behind the scenes, you know. It's, yeah, in a way the teaching bit is almost the easy bit. That's the fun bit, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
Like your reward for all the other stuff you have to do.
For sure. Do you think your studio, do you think it's going to be viable in the long term, or you just need to see how it goes?
Honestly, I don't know. I honestly don't know. For quite a long time, I've been asking myself, how long can I keep going working this hard for so little? Because I do work really, really hard. So I've got no problem with working hard. I would work hard regardless. And, you know, I kind of, you know, I guess maybe a lot of yoga teachers struggle with this. Like I sort of say, oh, I'm not, money's not my primary motivator, right? And I sort of, while that's true to a certain extent, part of me sort of feels like, well, you know, it's not wrong to want to earn more money, is it?
No.
You know, I'm working my socks off, right? And, you know, obviously I want, like everybody wants, to be sort of financially secure and, you know, having that freedom that financial security brings. And is it so very wrong that, yes, I would like to take my family to India once a year if I can afford it? And do you know what I mean? I suppose there's part of me that as a yoga teacher, you almost feel like a bit weird saying that actually, yes, I would like my studio to be more profitable, you know? But I don't, but why do we feel like that? Because other people don't struggle with that, do they?
No.
Questions. Nobody else would feel bad about saying I'd like to earn more money, would they?
No. A restaurant, a coffee shop.
Wouldn't, no, in fact, if you're not earning more money, then you're doing something wrong, aren't you? So, yeah, I don't know. Yeah, this has just been a really funny, not funny, ha-ha, but it's been a weird year, hasn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Have you got any advice for other people in your position, like studio owners?
I mean, you know, listen, my studio isn't hugely profitable. I'll be the first person to admit that. But I do feel that I have something of value to offer people, and I keep going, not really just for me, but for my clients that have been loyal, and also for my teachers. So even though they might not be teaching that many classes, you know, it's really hard for some of my teachers. There's hardly anything coming in, you know. Teaching has dried up. Yes, I've really appreciated teaching on Zoom, but it's not the same as teaching in person. We all know that. So I guess I would just say, you know, be prepared to diversify. I think we all know that, don't we? That, you know, maybe in a way this has been a good thing for a lot of us, because would I be teaching online if this hadn't happened? Probably not. And some people prefer it. So I'm kind of adding something else, aren't I? But yeah, I think, you know, with yoga, you really need to diversify, you know? So I'm trying to do corporate yoga, one-to-ones. Do you know what I mean? You can't, the studio on its own, if I just relied on the money that the studio brings in from those classes, you know, be a struggle.
Yeah, so you normally have five, you have five in now. How many would your studio normally hold then?
15.
Blimey. Yeah, it's not sustainable, is it, at all?
Well, I'm charging more now. So when I did the memberships, it was if people were sort of fully utilising their membership, they were effectively paying like less than £4 a class. So not everybody was, you know, fully utilizing their membership. So now I'm only doing, like, the drop-in is £12, or you can buy a block of five for £50, and that's it.
Yeah.
So some people will be prepared to pay that and some people won't.
Yeah, but if you've got five spots, you need them filled, don't you? That's the thing.
Yeah. And still, even now, I get people contacting me an hour before and saying, oh, I can't make the class, or after the class has started, or not showing up, and, you know.
It's going to become more of an issue, that, isn't it, I think?
Yes, I've got a 24-hour cancellation policy. And I'm going to have to stick to that, you know?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, the thing is, you know, like when you, I don't know about you, but like if you go to the beauticians or the hairdressers, they have a 24-hour cancellation policy, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, don't talk to me about hairdressers, right? I need to go again. I'm looking like a right moped, but not good. But no, so just trying to think of going back to more positive stuff, Indira, what's been your proudest moment so far?
So I was thinking about this, and part of me wants to say that I feel like my proudest moment is yet to come. In that I, you know, so I've got lots of ideas about things that I would like to do in the future, you know, and hopefully those dreams will come to fruition. So one of the things that I've wanted to do for a long time is write a book. So that's one day I'm going to write that book. another dream is that I really want to live on the beach, quite possibly in Goa in India. So when we moved, we were living in India for 7 months. That was kind of like dipping our toes in the water to see if that would be a viable option. So that's another dream of mine. But my proudest moment, my actual proudest moment, and it's sort of maybe a bit obvious, but it's having my children. So they're, you know, they're everything to me, and they'll always, much as I love yoga, and yoga is definitely a way of life for me, my children will always come first.
Yeah.
Always. Yeah.
Oh, so what's next for you? Like, what are your plans? Are you going to continue to write as well? I know you've been writing some articles. So are you going to continue that? Like, where do you see your focus being?
I am going to continue to write. I really enjoy writing. It's quite unfortunate that you're kind of expected to write for free these days, which is sort of a little bit of a bugbear of mine too, but that's the way it is. So ironically, like I mentioned that my husband is a journalist, so I have to be careful what I say now, but he's a production editor for a magazine, and so basically, a big part of what he does is he rewrites other people's copy. So other people, journalists who are paid to, you know, produce these articles or interviews, they write these articles and then they go to my husband and he rewrites them. Sometimes he has to completely rewrite them. And sometimes he gets stuff in where he's literally like, oh my God, you know, this is terrible. And he has to like pretty much rewrite the whole thing. And it's just so ironic that he's sitting in the room next to me rewriting copy that's been written really badly. Someone's been paid a lot of money to write that. He rewrites it, but obviously his name doesn't go on it. And then I'm sitting next door writing an article for which I'm not paid, you know?
Yeah.
So I get that, you know, we've reached a point where it's like, oh, it's citizen journalism, or, you know, anyone can write. Yes, anyone can write. Can everybody write well? Maybe not.
No. You know? You'd like to think your postgraduate studies were worth something, Indira, wouldn't you?
Well, I mean, from my time as a journalist, and from what I've already just told you, you can be a journalist. There are lots of different kinds of journalists. You can be a journalist who can't write, but maybe you're very good at bringing in stories. And I definitely knew journalists like that. You know, you might be good at getting the interview, getting the story, but maybe your writing isn't so great, you know. But I just think, you know, people, it's only fair for people to be paid for their time and their expertise, really, isn't it?
Totally. Yes, that's it. That is fair. Exactly. So if you weren't a yoga teacher or a reporter, you can't have that because you've been that already. What would you be?
Oh, a novelist. Yeah.
So yeah, still a writer.
Yeah. A novelist. I definitely want to write a book. Definitely.
Okay, we'll watch this space then. That's exciting. So quick fire questions now, Indira, no pressure. Just say what you gut tells you. And these are new quick fire questions. So, all right, we'll start it off. So First one, late to bed or early to rise?
Early to rise.
What's the oddest thing in your handbag?
Don't have a handbag.
What?
Only when I go out, I use a rucksack. So if I go out, I just put what I need in my handbag.
What's in your rucksack then? What's the oddest thing in your rucksack?
Oddest?
Yeah.
A teepee for like, you know.
Oh, that is odd. For tooth hygiene on the move. Teeth hygiene on the move. Yeah. Okay, that's good. What do you look up to, or who do you look up to?
What, living or deceased?
Doesn't matter.
Oh, I know it's a bit of a cliche, but I suppose the Dalai Lama, Thich Nhat Hanh, you know, Gandhi, Martin Luther King, Nelson Mandela. People like that.
Favourite film? If you've got a quote from it?
Oh my God. I don't think I've got a quote from it, but I actually think it's probably a bit sad for a grown woman to say this, but it might be Toy Story 3 or possibly E.T. Or maybe even Mary Poppins.
I love that you've got like three. You can't choose between them. On a scale of 1 to 10, how cool are you?
Oh, well, that's like a trick question. I'm going to say 6.
Safe. Yeah. Mountainside or lakeside?
Mountainside.
Tom Hanks or Leonardo DiCaprio?
Oh, what kind of a question is that?
I mean, it's a quick fire one, Indira.
I'm going to have to say Tom Hanks.
What's your star sign?
Aries.
Who would you swap lives with just for a day?
I'm going to say yoga girl, Rachel Breffin.
Yeah. Countryside or city?
Ooh. I'm going to say, can I have half and half?
Okay, I'll let you. If you owned a yacht, what would you call it?
Oh my God. no, I wouldn't call it that. I'd call it, God, what would I call it? I'd call it Indie.
Nice. What's at the top of your bucket list?
Move to the beach.
Describe your baddest and brightest leggings.
Oh, wow. Well, I've got a pair that it's almost like a picture, and it's like they've got like a safari, like a sort of safari halfway along. Yeah, I've got loads of loud leggings. Yeah.
And what's your favourite place in the whole world?
I'm going to have to say Goa in India. Patnam Beach, Goa, India.
Oh, I thought you might say that. Favourite yoga pose?
Downward dog.
Cool. Thank you. You threw it. You got through it. And just to take us on to your Savasana sounds, what's your favourite music or sound for Savasana? Like any tracks that you can recommend that we should have a listen to?
Yeah, so Devi Prayer by Craig, I think it's Prues and Ananda. That's what it comes up as on my Spotify. That's okay. A good one. And also there's one by Todd Norian. It's called Bija Soothing Sounds and Mantras. That's a good one as well.
Okay, I'll put the links to that on the episode notes so people can check it out. Oh, thank you so much for chatting to me, Indira. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's been so good to get to know you a bit better. So thank you. Listeners, you can contact Indira through her social media. She's on Instagram and Facebook, and her website is www.nlys, that stands for North London Yoga Studio, .co.uk. I'll say that again. It's www.nlys.co.uk. You've been listening to That Yoga Woman's podcast with me, Jules Buchanan. If you like the show, please tell your friends about it, share it on social media, rate it, write a nice review, and subscribe to That Yoga Woman's podcast. Links and information can be found on the episode page in the podcast section of my website, www.thatyogawoman.com/podcast. If you'd like to show some support for the podcast, you can do that through PayPal. The donation link is www.paypal.me/thatyogawoman. The last thing I'll mention is my line of organic cotton yoga-inspired tops. I designed a small range of best tees and sweatshirts that are perfect to teach or do yoga in. Have a look online, check out my shop on my website, www.thatyogawoman.com/shop. Have a look around my store and make an order. See you soon.